but I want to tell you a little secret. I really don't believe that anybody can do anything enthusiastically unless they enjoy doing it. And I want to let you know that I'm very enthusiastic about this conference, and it has been a real pleasure in the last 9 months in putting it together and being with you people. And the idea of the bridegroom is that it's a lot of nervous anxiety, but it's well worth it. And so I do hope that you took that, right? But enough recognition to me, because I would not have been able to do this alone, and I'm sure you would all understand that. And it took the work and cooperation of a really super committee that I'd like to recognize right now. And I'd like them to stand if they have had the time to come in and have dinner with us, and remain standing. Jerry Johnson, Noel McLaren, Ron Myers, Wilma Packard, Jim Paulus, Eric Riley, Harold Hayhurst. Harold has been doing the taping, and I'll mention this in case you didn't know it and you feel frustrated in trying to get around to all of the sessions. Tapes will be made available to you for the sessions, and you'll have an opportunity to sign up, I think, probably at the registration desk for those sessions that you would like tapes of, and they would be sent to you or some arrangements made. Tom Finnegan. He's my friend, too. He's in charge of the food. Bob Collins, Barbara Bowes, and Frank Blanchette, I know, is not here, and he was in charge of the brochure and a lot of the news release. And then a couple people that I have considered part of the committee that really weren't asked but ended up being very much a part of it, and I owe a great deal to them as far as the patience that they've endured. I took up Mr. Wine's room with the suite, and I think I took up a place at the table, at the head table. But I want to thank Tom. He's a lot more than just an executive director. He's a worker, too, as far as planning this conference. And also his right-hand lady, Carolyn. She's been terrific on the phone and come down only twice other than our meetings to help prepare for it. So I really thank both of them. And I also would like to, committee, you can sit down. My committee and I would like to give a very special thanks to Carolyn and to Tom, and also to the staff here at the Carousel, and in particular Sharon Travis, which has worked with us and done just a marvelous amount of work. And I hope that you will see that continue through tomorrow afternoon. Since this is my opportunity to offer some appreciation, I'd like you to offer some in return and appreciate the changes that I have to make in the program once again. And I'm going to take this time in order to give the rest of the time to Mercedes. If you'd just note these additions to the program. Tonight, after the banquet, for those of you who would like to take a look at some more of the films, or any of the films in their entirety, we're going to continue the film preview for anyone that's interested in the Glasgow Room, which is at the other end of the ballroom, shortly after the banquet. And feel free to request any film that you would like to see again in its entirety, or just take a glance at those that are available. I feel a little bit like one of the changes I would recommend to the people next year is that they put pencils in with the packet so you can make these changes. The second session tomorrow morning is in the bulletin is 10 to 10:15, and it's 10 to 10:50. And two additions, one that I mentioned this morning, is the last session from 11:10 to 11:55 tomorrow. There will be a man, his name is James Jenkins, and he will be here from Johnson Institute tomorrow at 11:10 in the green room. And the other session that we would like to make available to some certain people, we have formed an affiliation committee, and that was discussed at the board, or at the new board meeting tonight before dinner. And Bob Bednarik is in charge of that. He's chairing that committee. And we would like to request that any other agency representatives around the state of Ohio, such as OTSA, the Halfway House Association, any other associations that would like to participate in this session tomorrow, which will be forming the committee and beginning to work together to see how we can work better together as an Ohio Association of People concerned about the problem of alcoholism. So please keep that in mind, agency people, tomorrow at 11:10 in Parlor B. Okay? The last change is, the last two changes are that the psychosocial drama tomorrow after dinner or after lunch will be right here, so you won't have to move up to the yellow room as it states in the program. I don't think the yellow room would be big enough for us. And also, the first annual meeting of the Ohio Task Force on Women and Alcohol will meet tomorrow in the blue room at 3:15. Something that I like to save for last, because I always save the best for last, and I was really honored when Mr. Wine asked me if I would do this. I wanted to give a very special thanks from all of you to one very special person who's meant a great deal to me. He's been a tremendous friend for the last 2 years. He's given me some guidance. He's been kind of my resident pastor away from Bowling Green. And he's a person that I appreciate, not only for his sincerity, his kindness, his hosting the board meetings for the last 2 years at Central College Presbyterian Church. I'd like to ask Dick Ellsworth to come up, please. Dick paid a compliment to me today about my organization, and I have to reflect that right back to him, because I've admired his organization, and I think maybe some of it's rubbed off. But I think it's very timely that we do thank Dick just one more time for all that he's done for being organized and being on time. And we have a gift here that we'd like to give to Dick.
Oh, my goodness.
Thank you, Dick. You want to open it?
You want Well, I don't want to take any time from her.
Well, it's a time.
I'm hurried up. Okay. I'm very unaccustomed to seeing this. How do you get it out? Okay. Well. What do you know about this? A digital clock with an alarm on it, so that I'll be on board meetings on time. Oh, my goodness. Presented to, you're going to cause me to not read it, Reverend Richard D. Ellsworth, in appreciation for his 2 years devoted service as president of the Ohio Association for Alcoholism Programs. Thank you very much. Thank you.
And now to introduce our guest speaker, Elaine Kagan.
Between the idea and the reality, between the motion and the act, falls the shadow. These words, words borrowed from T.S. Eliot, are words of truth and challenge. And they might well describe the life of the woman that we have come together to hear tonight. She is going to speak about an illness and her recovery from it. That wouldn't be so unusual, except that the woman is a famous actress. The illness is alcoholism. And for the past 8 years, she has dedicated herself to educating the American public about alcohol and alcoholics. Today, she speaks to a receptive audience. 8 years ago, such an admission was not one easily made to any public, and not even to the recovery community. As our speaker says, it took more courage than I've got. Even today, the public still reflects the stigma of alcoholism, courage of those who are recovering and are willing to speak out and share the experiences of their recovery are the one thing that has somewhat diminished the stigma. The list of accomplishments for our speaker during her radio, stage, and film career are many. They include the Academy Award, rave reviews, and a recent outstanding action triumph in a screen performance in which she was never seen as the voice of the demon in The Exorcist. However, the recognition for outstanding accomplishments that is treasured the most is one from the National Council on Alcoholism, which pays tribute to her for her outstanding service in this field. Today, her acting career suspended, our speaker is the president and director of a nonprofit treatment center which has gained national recognition for its work in treating alcoholics. For these many, many reasons, and because during the brief time that we have been together, I have had all these things underlined and emphasized, I feel privileged to introduce Mercedes McCambridge. She has not only made outstanding contributions to the field of alcoholism, but she has given hope to many women who otherwise would not have sought help. Mercedes?
Thank you, Elaine, and good evening. Congratulations to all of you for caring enough to be here. I'm here because some months ago, returning from the National Council on Alcoholism Convention in San Diego, I spent what really seemed like a half-hour flight between San Diego and Chicago discussing alcoholism with Tom White. We got very heated. I think at one point I said he was an idiot. But we had a wonderful time, and for me a very learning experience, and I'm grateful to him for that. I worked very hard because of my regard for him and because my feeling of responsibility is considerable on such an occasion as this, on a speech which I wrote. I'm not going to use it. In 1952 and in 1956, I was honored to be asked to accompany my dearest friend in the whole world, Governor Adlai Stevenson of Illinois, on his two lamentably unsuccessful campaigns for the presidency of the United States. I remember saying to him once, why? I mentioned this to someone yesterday from your group. He was so very thrilled that we would be making the journey from New York to San Francisco, where he would address 30,000 people in the Cow Palace. And I said, I can't understand why this elates you so. They're all going to vote for you anyhow. They're all Democrats. Why aren't you across the street talking to two Republicans? I really feel that that holds true as far as my role in this field is concerned. What I have written might have a certain effect addressing a group of people who did not have a familiarity with alcoholism, but it would be a tiresome bore for you and a tedious waste of time for me to spout at you facts, figures, statistics, and theories which are already very familiar to everybody in this room. I believe that any true effectiveness I might have had in coming to Columbus has already been accomplished, and I am not in any way demeaning it or downplaying it, and that is through the appearances on the media today. That's where it's at. The fact that after I was very interested in Phil, I'm not sure I want to stay in a room where we've got a... What is it? A non-stipendiary Episcopalian? They're the worst kind. And a man who dares to stand up here and tell you what it's like to go through a full-term pregnancy. I'm not sure. But you Ohioans are very quaint. Interesting custom. But I do believe that certainly there's reason for all of us to continue in coming together and sharing our ideas in conferences, seminars, conventions, meetings, workshops, naturally. That's how the field is maintained and sustained. I think, however, what we should do more of is what we're not doing enough of. And that's addressing the great unwashed. I am convinced, beyond any shadow of a doubt, that despite all of the dedicated work done by people in this room and in rooms matching this all over the country in this field, no significant progress will be made until the attitude of the public is changed about who and what I am. I have a thing about words. The melody of words, non-stipendiary Episcopalian. That's a very satisfying thing to say. It has a nice sound to it. So actually does the word alcoholic. It's pleasant to say. It has a certain music to it. And it's a four-syllable word. But in too much of our society, even as I stand here, I am not a four-syllable word. I am still a four-letter word. I guess about 6 weeks ago in Washington, I found myself with uncommon fervor shouting at a luncheon in the National Press Club that everybody knows that alcoholism is a disease. The problem is that nobody believes it. And if that goes down hard with some of you, I am not here to win your approval. What Elaine said was true. The most difficult of my life, 8.5 years ago now, I had been free of alcohol for some considerable period of time before that. In July of 1969, I was telephoned by a friend in New York. I was on the coast, and this person said, "There's a United States Senator trying to reach you, and I don't want to give out your number without your permission." Well, it was a United States Senator, and I said, "By all means, give the Senator my number. Who is it?" And this person said, "Senator Harold Hughes of Iowa." I didn't know who he was. Oh, within a few moments, Harold Hughes called and told me, almost in the third sentence of our conversation, that he had a favor to ask of me, one that I perhaps would not fully understand at first, but would I hear him out? And I said, "Yes, Senator." And he said, "How would you like to come to Washington and testify before a Senate subcommittee as an alcoholic?" And I said, "You've got to be kidding, you know. I really thought that the people of Iowa had more sense than to elect somebody who has so little grasp on reality." "No, Senator, thanks very much, but no thanks." And he talked to me for a while, and what he said was, almost exactly what he said was, this was the one chance that this country might have for who knows how long a time to bring before the Congress a proposition which would develop into a bill which would become a law, hopefully, legalizing the disease of alcoholism. It was a long shot at that time. He knew it. And he said, "I have traversed this country now several times, back and forth, trying to get somebody to agree to testify whose name would, I quote, grab the media, unquote. He spoke of the various categories in our society, the clergy, industry, giants of industry, the military, the social services, government, medicine, the arts, the inexact and exact sciences. No. No one whose name would be immediately recognizable was willing to do it. So I said, you just run into another one. I'm not going to do it. No way am I going to do it. But he's a very persuasive fellow, even on the telephone, not having seen that granite face. And I said I would be in New York the following week. And he said, well, you come down to Washington and talk about it. And by the time I got to New York, the lobby had already been formed, the pressure group. Marty Mann, Bill Wilson. The giants in alcoholism. And I went to Washington and had dinner with all of those people the night before I testified. And I wrote out my testimony. And 5 minutes before the hearing began, I was sitting in Senator Hughes' office with him, and he said, you can stop now and back out, and I will understand. It's 5 minutes of nine. You don't have to go in there. And it will be all right, because as I said to you, there will be many areas in which you will be crucified. He said there will be many hits, and a lot of them will be beneath the belt. And that's the price you have to pay for doing this. So I'll understand if you say no. 40% of the time right now, I wish I'd said no. Maybe even more than 40%. I'll split 50-50 with you. I wish I'd said no. Half of my waking hours, I am convinced that it was the dumbest thing I ever did in my whole life. I'll tell you why. Anyhow, I went in. In the big semicircle of senators' chairs was on a raised platform, the big table, the Watergate hearing room type table, with the nest of microphones and the pitcher of water, was there. Behind the bench, the Washington Press Corps, Time Magazine, Newsweek, all the others. And arrayed in a little cluster were the witnesses who would testify that morning. Really great people in the field of alcoholism. Biochemists, doctors, judges, social service people, Bill W., who at that time had not broken his anonymity as the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, which was indeed at his request only broken at his death. Bill wrote his own obituary, as many of you know. When he testified, the cameras were on his back. But the rest of the time, when all of these people who had so much knowledge to impart to the public, while they were testifying, all cameras, black, no red lights, indicating that any of the cameras were on. Among the senators that day was a senator from Ohio, who went on to greater things, Senator Saxby. There was Senator Javits of New York, Senator Williams of New Jersey, Senator Kennedy of Massachusetts, Senator Tower of Texas, Senator Dominic of Colorado, all up there in those mighty chairs. And then Senator Hughes, as chairman, said, our next witness is the Academy Award-winning actress and alcoholic Mercedes McCambridge, and every single light in the place went on. Every single light. And you walk up and sit at that table and presume to tell the American public what you are. That was in 1969, July 29th. Last fall, calls from Washington. You're not going to believe this. I didn't. Will you come and testify before a Senate subcommittee on alcoholism as an alcoholic? And I said, you know, deja vu and echo augury, all those things. I've been through this before. I played this. This happened to me before. Well, you see, we can't get anybody else. And Senator Hathaway particularly wants you to come because it's the first subcommittee hearing on women and alcoholism. Will you come? And I said, no. No, I will not come. And as I explained to somebody, my reaction was that decisive because just a few weeks before that, I had been a speaker at an occasion like this at Cherry Hill in New Jersey for the New Jersey Council on Alcoholism. Senator Williams and his wife were co-chairing it, and I spoke. And the next day's Philadelphia Inquirer ripped my heart out. One of the most cruel, vicious newspaper pieces I've ever read. The writer said, among other things, all that was needed was the bouquet of roses for the performance that was put on last night for the New Jersey Council on Alcoholism. That's mild compared to some of the things she said. That I had more wrinkles in my face than a paper sack. Swell. Now they want me to come and do the whole thing over again. This is 1976. The original was 1969. Because nobody else was willing to do it. Who would grab the space in the media? So all of you who say, oh yes, isn't it marvelous how the stigma of alcoholism has been removed? Isn't it just splendid now that everybody knows it's a legal disease like diabetes and that no one certainly considers the alcoholic less than a first-class citizen? Forget it. That is not true. And I find it over and over and over again. Not only from the non-alcoholic, non-knowing population, the crank mail I get, which is fantastic, some of it. But from people within the field. And that's what really hurts. There are professionals, paraprofessionals, whom I've met now in some 500,000 miles of traveling as the honorary chairman of the National Council on Alcoholism for 3 years, and since then, back and forth across the country. It's my business. I earn my living and have all my life on picking up vibrations from people. I'm supposed to be able to read that as an actress, and I can very well. I was well taught and well trained, well schooled, and well experienced. Over and over again, there is behind the lip service of acceptance of me as a first-class citizen a very thin veil, which is, first of all, lofty condescension, but most of all, a separateness. Oh, yes, very definitely there. Within the field, moving one step closer to horror, among my peers, alcoholics, the stigma of what I am is sustained by far too many alcoholics themselves. I maintain, along with a great many other people, most recently I had a marvelous visit this afternoon with Dr. Rossiter. I was born an alcoholic, and you'll never prove to me that I wasn't. For those of you who don't believe in any of the new research, all right, that's your problem. I will match my moral fiber, my willpower, my success and involvement as a citizen, my gray matter, my success in my profession, my ability to be loved by my share of great men, my ability as a parent, with anybody in this room. The difference between me and the rest of society is that I cannot partake of a drug. That's it. That's the whole ball of wax. I am handicapped, according to the new umbrella definition out of HEW. Handicapped because I cannot partake of a drug? Is this a handicap? One in three people in this country are on something. Some chemical. Some mood-altering chemical to alter reality. It's just too hard to hack without a little help. One in three adults. I am not one of those alcoholics who believes that since alcohol has not entered my system, life is just a gorgeous, marvelous, beautiful pussycat time. I think life is a bitch. And as soon as my granddaughter, who is now 3 1/2, is able to understand it, and it's sooner than most of us think, I've asked her mother, my daughter-in-law, and my son, if that's what I can teach Amy over and over again. Life is a bitch, life is a bitch, life is a bitch. There are great moments of joy, Amy, but there are great moments of despair to counteract it. The trick is neither one of them lasts. I believe in what Emerson says, that the difference between the hero and the rest of us is that when the hero gets to the end of his rope and ties a knot in it and hangs on for 5 minutes longer. That's pretty much my modus vivendi. After now some considerable association with people like me, I disagree heartily with people who believe that alcoholics are egomaniacs. Self will run riot. I think at the basis of every alcoholic psychological problem is his lack of self-esteem. His lack of self-esteem. It's only been in the last maybe less than 3 years that I have stopped apologizing to furniture when I bump into it. I'm sorry. And in a minute. Contrary to what Elaine said, I have certainly not suspended my career. I act when it pleases me, in work that pleases me. And I say with typical alcoholic egomania, I've earned that right to do things that please me through this second-class brain of mine, so inferior to those who walk in some kind of spiritual magnificence. I don't have to work at all if I don't want to. And nobody gave it to me. And all that was ever struck on my parents' farm was soybeans, never oil or anything like that. I'm in very good shape, thank you. And don't have to do anything unwillingly. But just last Saturday night, what is that, less than 72 hours ago, at this time, I was on a stage in a magnificent play called J.B., which is the story of Job, as interpreted by Archibald MacLeish, won the Pulitzer Prize in 1959, magnificent play. My character, which is typecasting, I play the devil figure, is against the God figure, who are discussing Job's lot in life. I think Job was a fool, personally, to take all of that, but that's his problem. I don't know, you know, I think humility is a virtue, but I don't think it was ever meant to be the neurosis we've made it. I am bored with the hairy humble people. They really bore me. Garbage. And my character says, and each night that I have said it in the play, with great interior reverence within the buried temple of my own soul, I shared it with every alcoholic person I've ever known. My character says about mankind and his condition that we are given the dear gift of guilt. That putrid poultice of the soul that sucks the poison in, not out. That dirty thumb we chew on. And each night, each performance, that song of the suffering alcoholic was the refrain within my own heart. I drank because I was afraid of three things: God, sex, and being alone. I am a product of 16 years of convent education, wherein I was taught that I was born guilty because of some mix-up back there in a garden with some apple. My parents, I didn't even know. I don't think I'd have chosen them if I had any choice. Anyhow, they did this rotten thing, and I was born bad. That was removed, that badness, and I was okay until I was six, when I reached what is laughingly called the age of reason. Then I started to get bad again. And I just knew it was anything else. Never anything else. Mea culpa, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa. I am not worthy, I am not worthy, I am not worthy. All that time, some force outside myself, by sustaining the beat in my pulse, is seeing with every single beat that we, lonely, faithful, longing for me, insisting on me, is saying yes, 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 yes. And I say, no, 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 no. Nonsense. I was perfectly marvelous. Until I found out I was bad. Now I have found out I'm not so bad, and I'm perfectly marvelous. My body, second reason I drank. My body is the temple of the Holy Spirit, huh? Swell. Swell. And there it is, that temple. And certain things are no-no in that temple there. I had a guardian angel from the time I was a little girl. And in my church, only fellas could be guardian angels, no girls. Talk about equal rights. And I was very aware of this angel. So much so that when I was a little girl and had to go to the bathroom, I talked to him and said, please stay outside. I don't want you to go in there now. I'll be right out. Don't come in there now. Okay. Now I grow up with this temple, which my body is, and one morning, a man of the cloth, non-stipendiary or whatever, he wasn't an Episcopalian, I can tell you, but he might as well have been. I don't say that deprecatingly. That's just how the cookie crumbs. So a man of the cloth reads the words over me and my mate, and that night it's all right. Is it? No way. I'm still that temple. Then you got the guardian angel in the corner and St. Anthony in the other corner. No way. I can look you right in the eye and tell you with great tragic sadness. Regret is useless, so I won't use that word. But with a deep sense of mourning, that even in marriage, I have never completely lost the sense of guilt in sex. Some little part of me, there. Shame. Very keen. Now comes the marvelous drug. Ether and water. And alcohol. Case in point. My favorite television show, Mary Tyler Moore. The season before they went off, it was repeated twice. One of the top ten. Lou Grant comes in one morning, disheveled, unshaven, collar open, storms into his office, bangs the door. Mary and her colleagues are sitting up thinking, my God, what's gone wrong with him? She goes in to find out what's wrong with him, and he's taking the bottle out of his desk that he keeps there. Which, of course, is standard business practice. And he says, throw this out. I don't want any more of this. I'm through with this stuff forever, because last night I was out with Sue Ann, the cooking lady, Betty White's character, and we both got drunk, and we went back to her house and went to bed. And Mary, in order to make him feel better, said, that's nothing, Mr. Grant. That happens to a lot of people, you know. I was at a party once, and I met a perfect stranger, and I thought he was rather attractive. And we had too much to drink, and the same thing happened to us, and it was Walter Cronkite. That was the joke. What is it telling us? On primetime television, one of the top ten. They are telling us that neither one of them would do things like that if they were sober. The most hypocritical thing I ever heard of. Of course they'd do things like that if they were sober. Point is, they haven't got the guts. Does the ether and water make sexual monsters of all of us? So that the next morning we can apologize for being Burt Reynolds or Raquel Welch or whoever. Because nice people don't do that. Do we go to the liquor store and say, I want a fifth of Raquel Welch? Or if you're a fella, Burt Reynolds, you go home and drink down little genies and they take over? No way. Why is the foul deed usually committed in the dark and always after something to drink? Bad. You dirty people. Oh, I'm going to burn in hell is what you're going to do. Couldn't happen to a nicer box. And the third reason I drank was because I didn't want to be by myself. Small wonder. I just told you. Why no one could be by herself. All those years of rage, frustration, despair, anger, loneliness, bewilderment, questioning, confusing. There was no answer to why. All those years spent in flight from the long shadow of my lonely heart, which was breathing over my shoulder all the time, and finally, and almost too late, caught up with me. And I turned around, and it was me. The person I've been looking for all my life turns out to be me. I love the Palm Court in New York, the Plaza, one of the vestiges of elegance about New York. I can't tell you what it was like sitting there one afternoon with tea with some people with the delicate cucumber sandwiches and watercress sandwiches and, you know, three petty four cost $9. It doesn't matter. It's awfully pretty there. And the violins were playing and the palms were doing what palms do. And each one of the pillars, broader than the pillar in the center of this room, was faced with mirrors. And it was really very beautiful. I was sitting there and I'm looking around the room, really appreciating it in an aesthetic kind of way. And in the mirror, I caught sight of somebody and I winked. And it was me. For the early part of my life, I was perfectly marvelous and thought so. And then I stopped thinking so. And now I can look in the mirror in the Palm Court of the Plaza Hotel and wink at what I see. And I'm grateful for that. I don't believe that's ego. I believe it is perhaps learning the greatest of all human virtues. And that is enlightened self-esteem. Otherwise, I insult whatever force is insisting on me. I truly slap God in the face. If I... The giant scheme of things would be that much off base without me. There's a great saying from Seneca. I'm always so grateful for all of the writers who left what they said rather than tear it up, because I'm sure many people in this room, 4 out of the 7 Americans who have won the Nobel Prize for Literature, have been alcoholics. Isn't it marvelous that William Faulkner didn't tear it up the next morning? Isn't it marvelous that they left what they wrote? So many of us will write something at night and think, this is deathless prose. I get this published in the morning, be number one on the bestseller list, and the next morning to read it and think, this is garbage, and throw it up. I'm so glad that they didn't. I always tell students that in theater. But Seneca said, 2,000 years ago, maybe, something that is enough for me, really enough for me. And he wrote, I do not obey God. I agree with him. I wish every woman in Columbus dying of shame, because she is what I am, could feel that. But she will die in shame, because she is what I am. This is society can live with that. I don't understand society. But you'll be dead in the morning. Of something decent. And when I wonder why I do these things, perhaps it's because with any luck at all, I'll be here in the morning. Because I am what I am. When I graduated from college in Wonderland, then I read real stuff. Illinois. I graduated with honors. I was expected to go out and set the world on fire as a prime example of a convent-educated young lady. And I got out and did all the wrong thing. I got married twice, divorced twice, when in the show business became an alcoholic. Hardly your ideal girl graduate. One of the dear old nuns who was still there told me, Mercy, the church has come a long way, because when you first were divorced, your first divorce, and it was in the paper, and we turned your picture to the wall. And they did. But on June the 5th, which is what, just 4 or 5 months ago, I walked up the aisle of my auditorium in that college onto my stage with a doctor's hood on my back and delivered the commencement. Not because I was an actress. They asked me to deliver the commencement to the graduating class in my school because I am an alcoholic. Why did that woman have to die tonight? Because that's what she did. Think about it. Thank you.